This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Why Fish Don't Exist, a story of loss, love, and the hidden order of life by Lulu Miller. Read by the author.
This is for you, Dad. Prologue. Picture the person you love the most. Picture them sitting on the couch, eating cereal, ranting about something totally charming, like how it bothers them when people sign their emails with a single initial instead of just taking those four extra keystrokes to finish the job. Chaos will get them. Chaos will crack them from the outside with a falling branch, a speeding car, a bullet, or unravel them from the inside with the mutiny of their very own cells. Chaos will rot your plants and kill your dog and rust your bike. It will decay your most precious memories, topple your favorite cities, wreck any sanctuary you can ever build. It's not if, it's when. Chaos is the only sure thing in this world, the master that rules us all. My scientist father taught me early that there is no escaping the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy is only growing. It can never be diminished, no matter what we do. A smart human accepts this truth. A smart human does not try to fight it. But one spring day in 1906, a tall American man with a walrus mustache dared to challenge our master. His name was David Starr Jordan, and in many ways it was his day job to fight chaos. He was a taxonomist, the kind of scientist charged with bringing order to the chaos of Earth by uncovering the shape of the great tree of life. That branching map said to reveal how all plants and animals are interconnected. His specialty was fish, and he spent his days sailing the globe in search of new species, new clues that he hoped would reveal more about nature's hidden blueprint. For years he worked, for decades, so tirelessly that he and his crew would eventually discover a full fifth of fish known to man in his day. By the thousand, he reeled in new species, dreaming up names for them, punching those names into shiny tin tags, dropping the tags alongside their specimen into jars of ethanol, slowly stacking his discoveries higher and higher. Until one spring morning in 1906, an earthquake struck and toppled his shimmering collection to the ground. Hundreds of jars shattered against the floor. His fish specimens were mutilated by broken glass and fallen shelves. But worst of all were the names. Those carefully placed tin tags had been launched at random all over the ground. In some terrible act of genesis and reverse, his thousands of meticulously named fish had transformed back into a heaping mass of the unknown. But as he stood there in the wreckage, his life's work eviscerated at his feet, this mustachioed scientist did something strange. He didn't give up or despair. He did not heed what seemed to be the clear message of the quake, that in a world ruled by chaos, any attempts at order are doomed to fail eventually. Instead, he rolled up his sleeves and scrambled around until he found, of all the weapons in the world, a sewing needle. He took the needle between his thumb and forefinger, laced it with thread, and aimed it at one of the few fish he recognized amid the destruction. With one fluid movement, he plunged the needle through the flesh at the fish's throat, and then he used the trailing thread to stitch a name tag directly to the flesh itself. For each fish he could salvage, he repeated this tiny gesture. No longer would he let the tin tag sit precariously in the jars. Instead, he sewed each name directly to the creature's skin, a name stitched to its throat, to its tail, to its eyeball. It was a small innovation with a defiant wish that his work would now be protected against the onslaughts of chaos, that his order would stand tall next time she struck. When I first heard about David Starr Jordan's attack on chaos, I was in my early 20s, starting out as a science reporter. Instantly, I assumed he was a fool. The needle might work against a quake, but what about fire or flood or rust or any of the trillion modes of destruction he hadn't thought to consider? His innovation with the sewing needle seemed so flimsy, so short-sighted, so magnificently unaware of the forces that ruled him. He seemed to me a lesson in hubris, an Icarus of the fish collection. But as I grew older, as chaos had her way with me, as I made a wreck of my own life and began to try to piece it back together, I started to wonder about this taxonomist. Maybe he had figured something out about persistence or purpose or how to go on that I needed to know. Maybe it was okay to have some outsized faith in yourself. Maybe plunging along in complete denial of your doomed chances was not the mark of a fool, but it felt sinful to even think it, a victor? So one wintry afternoon when I was feeling particularly hopeless, I typed the name David Starr Jordan into Google and was met with a sepia photograph of an old white man with a bushy walrus mustache. His eyes looked a little hard. "Who are you?" I wondered. "A cautionary tale? Or a model of how to be?" I clicked through to more pictures of him. There he was as a boy, suddenly lamb-like with spilling dark curls and protruding ears. There he was as a young man, standing upright in a rowboat. His shoulders had filled out and he was biting his lower lip in a way that could almost be classified as sultry. There he was as a grandfatherly old man, sitting in an armchair scratching a shaggy white dog. I saw links to articles and books he had written, fish collecting guides, taxonomic studies of the fishes of Korea, of Samoa, of Panama. But there were also essays about drinking, and humor, and meaning, and despair. He had written children's books, and satires, and poems, and best of all, for the lost journalist seeking guidance in the lives of others, an out-of-print memoir called The Days of a Man, packed tight with so many details about said days of said man that it had to be broken into two volumes. It was nearly a century out of print, but I found a used book dealer who would sell it to me for $27.99. When the package arrived, it felt warm, enchanted, as if it contained a treasure map. I slid a steak knife through the packing tape, and two olive green tomes spilled out, each glittering with gold letters. I made a huge pot of coffee and sat down on the couch, the first volume on my lap, ready to find out what becomes of you when you refuse to surrender to chaos. Chapter 1. A Boy with His Head in the Stars. David Starr Jordan was born on an apple orchard in upstate New York in 1851 at the darkest time of the year, which is perhaps why he became so preoccupied with the stars. "While husking corn on autumn evenings," he writes of his boyhood, "I became curious as to the names and significance of the celestial bodies." He could not just enjoy their twinkling. He found them a mess he needed ordered, known. When he was about 8 years old, he got his hands on an atlas of astronomical charts and began comparing what he saw on the page to what he saw above his head. Night by night he went, creeping out of the house, attempting to learn the name of every star in the sky. And according to him, it took only 5 years to bring order to the entire night sky. As a reward, he chose Star as his middle name and wore it proudly for the rest of his life. Having mastered the celestial, David Starr Jordan turned to the terrestrial. His family's land swelled and rolled with its own unique constellations of trees, boulders, farm buildings, and livestock. His parents kept him busy with chores, shearing the sheep, clearing brush, and, David's specialty, sewing rags into rugs, his flexor tendons learning early how to wield a needle. But in between chores, David began to map the land. For help, he turned to his big brother, Rufus, 13 years older, a quiet and gentle nature lover with deep brown eyes. Rufus taught David how to settle the horses, with long strokes down the neck, where in the thickets to find the juiciest blueberries. Watching Rufus demystify the earth, David was transfixed. He says he held Rufus in absolute worship. Slowly, David began drawing intricate maps of everything they saw. He drew maps of his family's orchard, his walk to school, and when he finished the land he knew, he turned to places far away. He copied charts of distant townships, states, countries, continents, until his hungry little fingers had crawled over nearly every corner of the globe. "The eagerness I then displayed," he writes, "rather worried my mother, a large woman named Hulda. One day, having had enough, she took his whole pile of maps, creased and stained with his boyish sweat, and chucked it." Why? Who knows? Perhaps it was because Hulda and her husband Hiram were devout Puritans. They prided themselves on martyry accomplishments like never laughing out loud and beating the sun to the fields each morning. Spending one's time making maps of lands already mapped would have seemed like a frivolity, an insult to the use of a day, especially when they were struggling as they were, when there were apples to pick and potatoes to hoe and rags to sew. Or perhaps Hulda's disapproval was simply a reflection of the times. By the mid-19th century, the obsessive ordering of the natural world was beginning to fall out of fashion. The Age of Discovery had started over 400 years before and pretty much wrapped up in 1758 when the father of modern taxonomy, Carl Linnaeus, finished his masterpiece, Systema Naturae, a proposed blueprint for all the interconnections of life. No matter that Linnaeus's chart was riddled with mistakes, misfiling bats as primates and sea urchins as worms, to name a couple. As boats raced more frequently from port to port, the excitement of glimpsing exotic specimens and maps, once a way of luring people into shops, taverns, coffee houses, was wearing off. Dust was collecting upon cabinets of curiosity. The world, it seemed, had become known. Though there's a chance it could have been something else. At that very moment, a blasphemous text was screeching through the presses. On the Origin of Species was released to the masses in 1859, just as little David was beginning to scrunch his nose up at the stars. Is there any possibility that Hulda could have read the newspapers, could have sensed that the order of the natural world was about to cave in? Whatever the reason, Hulda would not budge. With her fist full of David's crumpled maps, she told her son to find something more relevant to do with his time. Like a good boy, he obeyed. He stopped making maps. But like a real boy, he did not. Not really. The country round about my home was very rich in wildflowers, he writes, trying to blame the earth for his sin. On his way home from school, he began to ever so occasionally pluck a velvety blue pom-pom or silken orange star from the grass. Some he'd sniff and let fall to the ground, but occasionally one would linger in his fingers and make it back to his bedroom, where it would lie on his bed and taunt him with its mysterious arrangement of petals. He would try to suppress his desire to know it, its name, its exact location on the tree of life, and he did pretty well, until puberty hit. On his first day of middle school, David secreted home from the library a little book on flowers, and back in the privacy of his room, he'd sit, manual in hand, desk dirty with flowers, discerning which flower was which, unbuttoning its genus, its species. A near man now with some hair on his toes, his voice dropping, he'd occasionally taunt his mother by revealing the scientific names of the blossoms they walked by, transmuting periwinkles into Vinca major or sunflowers into Helianthus annuus, as though to say that this passion of his could not be swatted out of him, crumpled up or thrown away. I perhaps strained a point by adorning the conveniently white walls of my bedroom with the names of the different plants as I identified them in turn, he writes. He began keeping questionable company with a poor farmer up the road named Joshua Ellenwood, who had learned the scientific name of almost every plant in the region. For accomplishing such a feat, the old man was regarded by his neighbors as shiftless and a waster of time. David was in awe of him. He began trailing the old man on his walks through the countryside, trying to seep up as many of his tricks as possible, the ways species revealed themselves in leaf shape or petal count or aroma. After meeting Joshua, David renounced his love of beauty, declaring that the dull and ugly flowers, the dandelions, Taraxacum officinale, and buttercups, Ranunculus acris, held better clues to nature's blueprint. The little ones, he wrote, even though not beautiful, meant more to me than 100 big ones all of a kind. A special proof of scientific as distinguished from aesthetic interest is to care for the hidden and insignificant. The hidden and insignificant. Could David be revealing something about himself in there? Though he doesn't let on to it much in his memoir, the human world could be hard on him. The historian Edward McNall Burns writes that when David's parents enrolled him in a boarding school, the girls did not consider him too promising, for it is said that the other young males were sometimes hauled up at night to the girls' dorm in a basket intended to be used for elevating fuel. David, alas, never once got to experience the miracle of basket flight. As he grew up, the outside world seemed to grow harsher. He writes of skating out onto an ice pond only to get in a tussle with a boy much smaller than him, of trying to sing but being told to quit by his music teacher, of the baseball game he joined at the age of 16 that ended abruptly when he dove for a fly ball and was let off with a broken nose, which, being badly set, has ever since remained slightly askew. And then there was his first teaching gig, his pupils, a group of unruly boys in a nearby town. For weeks, David attempted to maintain some semblance of order by conducting class with a wooden pointer. He'd wave it around, trying to focus their attention, occasionally even whapping the worst of the boys with it. Until, that is, the boys revolted. They descended upon David, grabbed his trusty pointer, and set it on fire. He writes of turning to more solitary pleasures, reading adventure stories and poetry, consuming himself with the task of trying to clasp my hands and jump through them. But even in solitude, he wasn't safe. One day, when David was 11 years old and happily engaged in the congenial task of burning stumps, his older sister Lucia appeared at the doorway to their farmhouse, screaming, as he recalls it, that if I wanted to see my brother alive, I must hurry to the house. David was confused. Rufus wasn't even supposed to be home. A passionate abolitionist, he had recently left to enlist in the Union Army. But before getting to set foot on the battlefield, before getting to test the strength of his conviction, Rufus had contracted a mysterious illness in training camp. It was a sickness that moved quickly through his body, raising his temperature and boiling his skin with rose-colored spots, a disease with no known cause or cure in those days called simply Army Fever. Decades later, it would be named typhus. When David reached his brother's bedside, Rufus's compass-like eyes were lolling and loose, barely able to focus. David stayed by the bed for hours, willing the fates to restore some strength to his brother's body. The next morning, Rufus did not wake. I still remember the long period of loneliness and distress after his untimely death, David writes. Night after night, I would dream that it was not true and he had returned safe and sound. After Rufus's death, David's journals explode with color. Meticulously rendered sketches of wildflowers and ferns and ivies and brambles at any scraps of nature, it seemed he could tear away from the world. The drawings are not artful. They are labored, covered in pencil smudges, ink stains, eraser marks, and little tears from overly vigorous coloring in. But in the crudeness, you can see it. His obsession, his desperation, the near muscular effort he was exerting to pin down the forms of things unknown to him. Beneath each drawing, there is, finally, a scientific name. The ink runs suddenly smoother, the letters looping with a bit of command. Campanula rotundifolia, Camia glauca, Astragalus canadensis. David describes the sensation of speaking the names out loud, those Latin declarations of victory, mastery. Their appellations, he writes, are as honey on my lips. Psychologists have studied this, by the way. The sweet salve that collecting can offer in times of anguish. In Collecting an Unruly Passion, psychologist Werner Munsterberger, who counseled compulsive collectors for decades, notes that the habit often kicks into high gear after some sort of deprivation or loss or vulnerability, with each new acquisition flooding the collector with an intoxicating burst of fantasized omnipotence. Francisca Lopez Torresillas, who's been studying collectors for years at the University of Granada, noted a similar phenomenon, that people experiencing stress or anxiety would turn to collecting to soothe their pain. When people have this feeling of personal inefficiency, she writes, compulsive collecting helps them in feeling better. The only danger, as Munsterberger warns, is that, as with any compulsion, there seems to be a line where the habit can switch from exhilarating to ruinous. As David grew older, as his shoulders filled out and his lips plumped, his hunger for new specimens only intensified. But he couldn't seem to find anyone who cared. No matter how hard he studied, no matter how many species names he learned or taxonomy papers he was able to get published, he explains, at school no attention was paid to this interest of mine. He got into Cornell University, earning a bachelor's and a master's degree in science in just 3 years, but he had trouble finding work. Universities were looking for sociable men in smartly tied ties who could command a classroom with a pointer and charm. The quiet, skinned knee, dirty elbowed, crawling around in nature that David so loved was looked down upon as child's play. And so it could have gone for David. Him desperately driven to collect flowers, the world unconvinced of his calling's worthiness, time passing as he slowly dug himself deeper and deeper into a leafy loneliness. Had he not stepped foot on Penakis Island. Chapter 2, A Prophet on an Island. Penakis Island sits 14 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. At just under a mile long, with barely any tree cover to protect from the beating sun, It has been called the runt of its island chain, a sad and lonely little rock, and an outpost of hell. Yet for some reason, its naked shores have always been a spot where people have tried to cultivate hope. In the early 1900s, it was a leper colony, led by a doctor who wanted to find a way to cure his wards. In the 1950s, it was converted into a bird sanctuary, where naturalists tried to reverse the fates of a plummeting tern population. In the 1970s, the island became a reform school for delinquent or wayward or troubled boys, the name depended on the decade, where a marine and fisherman hoped a regimen of seclusion, manual labor, animal husbandry, boat building, communal living, and schoolwork could, quote, turn a lot of potential murderers into car thieves, end quote. By the time I learned of the island, it had become a heroin recovery center where people addicted to the drug could try to get clean once and for all. But before all that, back in David Starr Jordan's day, the group seeking salvation on the lonely little rock? Naturalists. By 1873, when David was a freshly minted Cornell grad, one of the most famous naturalists of the day, Louis Agassiz, had grown gravely concerned about the future of the trade. Agassiz was a Swiss geologist, a charismatic bear of a man with bushy mutton chops who had earned his fame by being one of the earliest proponents of the Ice Age theory. Agassiz had only come to this vision of an earth coated in ice after making meticulous observations of fossils and scratch marks in the bedrock. As a result, he believed that the best way to teach science was to scrutinize nature. Study nature, not books, was his motto, and he was known for locking students in a closet with dead animals and not allowing them to emerge until they had discovered all the truths which the objects contained. In his 40s, Agassiz took a job at Harvard and was troubled by what he found there. No digging around in the dirt, no students locked in closets with tiny rotting corpses, just papers and tests and recitations regurgitating the beliefs printed in science books. This approach concerned Agassiz, who warned that science generally hates beliefs. As late as the 1850s, for example, many respectable scientists still believed in the idea of spontaneous generation, the belief that fleas and maggots could spring forth from particles of dust. A few decades before that, scientists believed in a magical substance called phlogiston that determined whether or not a material would burn. At that very moment, people had no way of protecting their loved ones against mysterious illnesses like army fever, bacteria having not yet been discovered as the cause of that disease. No, if you were satisfied with the beliefs of the day, Agassiz worried, it kept you stunted, stymied, sick. The way out, the way to enlightenment, was to keep looking closer, longer at the pebbles and petals and pelts of this world. So Agassiz dreamed of creating a safe haven where he could right this wrong, a kind of summer camp for young naturalists where he could teach the art of direct observation out in nature. And when, in 1873, a wealthy landowner offered to donate Penakees Island to the cause, he jumped at the opportunity. Its location was ideal, an hour from the mainland, easy enough to access, yet far enough to feel free. So was its size, big enough to roam, but small enough to never get lost. And as for the subjects available for study on Penakees, well, where to begin? Coating its treeless shores was a lush carpet of seagrass, which whipped in the wind and rustled with treasures, crabs, dragonflies, snakes, mice, crickets, plovers, beetles, owls. There were also the tide pools, silty with snails and seaweed and barnacles. And perhaps Agassiz's favorite, the big blonde boulders scattered like clunky teeth all over the island, some of them over 15 feet tall, which revealed in their scratch marks the direction the mighty glacier had been traveling some 20,000 years before. Finally, there was the lovely lapping sea itself, a sapphire platter that offered endless riches, sea stars, jellies, oysters, urchins, rays, horseshoe crabs, sea squirts, bioluminescence, and fish after glorious, slimy, shimmering fish. The naturalists' nets would never come up empty. For a person hoping to teach using nature itself, the place was a gold mine. As Agassiz began shipping lumber to the island to construct the camp, David Starr Jordan sat halfway across the country in Galesburg, Illinois, reading the newspaper. He had finally landed a job, teaching science at a small Christian university called Lombard College, but he was miserable. He felt isolated geographically and spiritually. His colleagues criticized him for teaching the blasphemous Ice Age theory, and worse, for allowing his students to handle lab instruments and waste chemicals. It was cold in Illinois, and the earth was flat, and he missed the flowering gorges of his youth. But one dark morning in early spring, he flipped the page of his newspaper and came across an ad for a course of instruction in natural history to be delivered by the seaside, by none other than Louis Agassiz himself. I pictured David snarfing his morning coffee out his nose, but it wouldn't have been coffee because he was a lifelong teetotaler, eschewing not just booze and tobacco, but even caffeine for its dangerous ability to alter perception. So perhaps he snarfed water, snarfed herbal tea, snarfed something in disbelief that such a place could exist. He applied to the camp as fast as he could. Within weeks, the mail brought his letter of acceptance, his ticket out of Illinois, signed by Agassiz's very own hand. Just a few months later, on July 8, 1873, David Starr Jordan stepped onto a pier in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and beheld the ocean for the very first time. He was 22 years old. Slowly, more and more young naturalists began gathering beside him on the dock, a mix of young men and women. It was a beautiful morning. The bay was calm, the sky a brilliant blue. A tugboat was headed their way, ready to shuttle them off to the faraway speck on the horizon. The boat threw down its planks and the 50 young naturalists walked aboard. It's lost to time what the campers talked about as they chugged out into the waves. Maybe they exchanged tall tales about the fauna of their homelands, asked one another to which kingdom they pledged their allegiance, animal, vegetable, or mineral. Maybe, if asked, David would have replied with one of his trustiest jokes that, due to the dense ivy that overtook the walls of his boyhood home, he became a botanist in self-defense. Or perhaps he stayed glued to the boat's railing, scanning those rolling gray waves for slips of skin. He confessed to a lingering shyness in those years, a wariness of new places. Perhaps he consoled himself with that age-old technique of finding refuge in nature. About an hour later, the tugboat shifted its engines into a lower gear and began its approach to the island. From his spot on the deck, David could make out the silhouette of a long dock with a human standing at the tip. He writes, "None of us will ever forget his first sight of Agassiz. We had come down from New Bedford in a little tugboat in the early morning, and Agassiz met us at the landing place on the island. He was standing almost alone on the little wharf, and his great face beamed with pleasure. His tall, robust figure, broad shoulders bending a little under the weight of his years, his large, round face lit up by kindly dark brown eyes, his cheery smile. He greeted us with great warmth as we landed. He looked into our faces to justify himself in making choice of us among the many whom he might have chosen." After greeting each student with a handshake, the great naturalist led them up the hill to see the new dormitory. It wasn't in the best of shape, construction having run longer than Agassiz had anticipated. The window panes hadn't been installed yet, nor had the shingles, and the wall that was to separate the men's from the women's sleeping quarters was, at present, just a flimsy sailcloth hanging from a rafter. Some of the students were horrified. Frank H. Latton, a young bird watcher from Rochester, thought the island's desolate location, ramshackle buildings, and inescapable sun made it feel like a kind of hell. "Viewed simply in itself," he writes, "it was a most unattractive spot, and at first I could scarcely persuade myself that I could enjoy my stay here." But eyes, tricky organs, show different people different things. That same hot earth beckoned to David, its golden sand glittering with mysterious seashells, sponges, seaweed. As the students were beginning to socialize, to flirt, to choose their beds in those long rows of cots, David slipped down to the shore, his fingers grazing salt water for the very first time. He picked up a smooth black stone, then a greenish one, his mind flooding with the panic of his life. Is this hornblende? Is this epidote? How do you tell them apart? In time, he was called to join the group up at the barn for a mid-morning meal. The sheep had been dragged out only a few days before, four-legged tables dragged in, so the building would have had the smell of hay, of urine, of grass, of life. Spiderwebs and swallow nests still presided from the rafters. This was to be their main classroom for the summer. The students took their places at long tables and chatted away as they dug into their food. There's a chance that during breakfast, David glimpsed a flash of auburn hair belonging to a young botanist from Massachusetts named Susan Bowen. The two would grow close that summer, exploring the shores of Penakis by moonlight, slipping their ankles into the black waves to ignite firework displays of twinkling green bioluminescence. As the meal concluded, Agassiz rose from his chair to deliver his welcome speech. It was a benediction too beautiful, according to David, to ever recreate. What Agassiz said that morning can never be said again. Luckily for us, the famous poet John Greenleaf Whittier was also in attendance that summer, and he did not agree with David's assessment. Whittier would later publish a poem called The Prayer of Agassiz, recounting that very speech. He starts with a bit of scene setting, on the Isle of Penicis, ringed about by sapphire seas, and then he gets to it, to Agassiz's benediction, the reason collecting mattered. Said the master to the youth, "We have come in search of truth, trying with uncertain key door by door of mystery. We are reaching through his laws to the garment hem of cause, him the endless unbegun, the unnameable, the one, light of all our light, the source, life of life and force of force. As with fingers of the blind, we are groping here to find what the hieroglyphics mean of the unseen in the seen." I've never been great at poetry, but if I'm decoding those capitalizations right, then what the taxonomists were searching for as they ogled their precious weeds and rocks and snails was the unnameable, the one, the source, the force, the truth, the unseen God? Indeed, in his writings, Agassiz is clear. He believes that every single species is a, quote, thought of God, and that the work of taxonomy is to literally, quote, translate into human language the thoughts of the creator. Specifically, Agassiz believed that hiding in nature was a divine hierarchy of God's creations that, if gleaned, would provide moral instruction. This idea of a moral code hidden in nature, a hierarchy, a ladder or gradation of perfection, has been with us for a long time. Aristotle envisioned a holy ladder, later Latinized to scala naturae, in which all living organisms could be arranged in a continuum of lowly to divine, with humans at the top, followed by animals, insects, plants, rocks, and so on. And Agassiz believed that by arranging these organisms into their proper order, one could come to discern not just the intent of a holy maker, but perhaps even the instructions for how to become better. Some hierarchies seemed obvious to Agassiz. Take posture, for example. Humans revealed their superiority by how they stood, quote, looking heavenward, while fish, quote, lay prostrate within the water. But other hierarchies were more subtle. Look at the parrot, the ostrich, and the songbird. Who among them is the highest on the ladder? If you could crack that, Agassiz figured, then you could learn which mattered more to God, speech, size, or song. But how do you crack the code? Well, that's where things got fun. That's where the microscopes and magnifying glasses came in. Using what Agassiz believed were objective measures about organisms, such as the complication or simplicity of their structure or the character of their relations to the surrounding world, you could rank organisms in their proper order. Lizards, for example, would score higher than fish because they, quote, bestow greater care upon their offspring. Parasites, meanwhile, were clear lowlifes, the lot of them. Just look at how they earned their living. They mooched and deceived and freeloaded. But the most valuable lessons, Agassiz believed, lay hidden under the skin. At some point during his lecture on Penicis Island, Agassiz would have warned his students about the danger of outerwear, whatever scales or feathers or quills a creature wore. This outerwear could be a dangerous distraction, a red herring that could fool a taxonomist into seeing similarities between creatures where there were none. Hedgehogs and porcupines, for example. On the outside, they're so similar. On the inside, they're a world apart. Agassiz explained that the best way to get to God was with a scalpel, to split the skin and look inside. That was where you would discover the true relations of the animals, in their bones, their gristle, their guts. That was where the divine thoughts lay most exposed. Take fish, for example. All the fish swimming just outside the barn at that very moment. Pluck one from the ocean, skin it, and you would discover a very clear message from God. Quote, "We cannot understand the possible degradation and moral wretchedness of man without knowing his physical nature is rooted in the fish," he writes. To Agassiz, the shockingly similar skeletal plan of fish, their skulls, their vertebrae, their rib-like protrusions, represented a warning to man. They were scaly reminders of how far a person could slip if he didn't resist his base urges. Quote, "The moral and intellectual gifts that distinguish him from the fish are his to use or to abuse. He may sink as low as the lowest of his type, or he may rise to a spiritual height." As Agassiz aged, he eased up just slightly on the idea of the fixity of species in order to leave room for a concept he called degeneration. He worried that even the highest of creatures could fall from their rungs if they weren't careful, that bad habits could somehow cause a species to physically and cognitively decline. In this way, Agassiz presented nature as a sacred text. Even the dullest slug or dandelion could offer spiritual and moral guidance to those humans curious enough to look. Take all those messages in aggregate and you get the intricate, awe-inspiring shape of what he called the divine plan, God's fable-rich explanation of the meaning of it all, not just how all organisms are ranked, but the very roadmap written in a convoluted set of morals to ascension. The swallows flew in and out of the building in the soft summer air, for they did not know that it was no longer a barn, but a temple, writes David Starr Jordan, finally able to use his words again. Agassiz pressed a nub of white chalk to the blackboard. "A laboratory is a sanctuary where nothing profane should enter," he wrote. To conclude the lecture, he asked his students to bow their heads in silent prayer to consider the gravity of their summer ahead. According to the poet, even the birds obeyed. Once the solemn hush had passed over the barn, Agassiz warned that those who did not take their time on the island seriously would be sent home. I imagine David lying awake on his cot that night, staring at the wooden rafter above his head, feeling his world rearranged. Yes, here at last were the words to convince his mother, his classmates, his colleagues so unmoved by his pursuits. What he was doing with those flowers in his hands was not pointless or wasteful or shiftless. It was, as Agassiz himself had defined it, missionary work of the highest order. It was the work of deciphering God's plan, the meaning of life, and possibly even the path to building a better society. I picture David breathless, ecstatic, eyes on that rafter, realizing that even in trying to classify that wood, was it pine, cedar, oak, was to do the most purposeful work on the planet. A whole childhood reclaimed, he must have been giddy, heart racing, which is perhaps why he didn't hear the rustling of sheets. The rustling of women's bodies just a couple of millimeters away through that flimsy sailcloth. The rustling of the auburn-haired woman who was at that moment climbing out of her clothes and into her sheets. Skin on sheets making a rustling which must have agitated some of the male sleepers because a group of them stuffed a pillow into a blanket and threw the ungainly wad over the as-yet-unclassified rafter. Some of the women screamed and some groaned, and the next morning, according to David, Agassiz was distinctly stern. At breakfast, he rose and said that six young men, whose names he gave, would leave by the steamer at 10 o'clock. Various appeals were now made. The women didn't mind it. It was only a student prank and had no significance. But he remained firm. "We were there for serious purpose," he said. "It was not the place or time for pranks." Shortly after those six young men boarded the steamer home in shame, David stepped onto a little schooner, rattling with nets and buckets and pride. Having caught Agassiz's eye that first morning as he explored the shoreline inspecting rocks, David was one of the few campers chosen to come along on the first dredging expedition. "Here I made my first acquaintance with the fishes of the sea," David sings, "which were brought up in bewildering variety." He doesn't put names to any of the creatures flopping around in that net, for at that moment they were still mysteries to him, the shimmering and scaly clues beckoning him to a puzzle he would spend the rest of his life trying to solve. Chapter 3, A Godless Interlude. Maybe Cape Cod is fertile ground for existential transformation. Something about the metals in its sandy soil catalyzing metaphysical shifts, I don't know. All I know is that I, too, had my entire worldview rearranged when I was visiting its shores. It happened when I was about 7 years old, and oddly enough, it was that moment that would pave the way for my obsession with David Starr Jordan, that would make him the kind of person I hoped could save me when my life later unraveled. It was early morning, early summer. I was on vacation with my family in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, just 50 miles as the crow flies from Penicuik Island. I was standing on the deck with my father, trading off a pair of clunky black binoculars, gazing out into a yellow and green expanse of marsh which rolled out before us. We were trying to get a better look at a white dot that we had noticed in the distance. My dad was a tall, mustachioed man, with a mane of jet black hair in those days, cut off jean shorts, no shirt, and a fuzzy, friendly belly nearly always offering a pastel fleck of lint. The rest of the house, my mom, my two older sisters, our cats, was still asleep. Unable to get the lenses to focus properly, I had just handed the binoculars back to my dad. I kept staring at the white dot nestled in the reeds, wondering if it was a swan, a buoy, something more exciting, when for some reason that I cannot recall, I asked my dad, "What's the meaning of life?" Maybe it had been the expansiveness of the marsh, which ended at the ocean, which ended, I didn't understand where. I pictured an edge with sailboats tipping off, that made me suddenly wonder what we are all doing here. My dad paused, raising one black eyebrow behind the binoculars. Then he turned to me grinning and announced, "Nothing." It felt like he had been waiting eagerly for my whole life for me to finally ask. He informed me that there is no meaning of life. There is no point. There is no God, no one watching you or caring in any way. There is no afterlife, no destiny, no plan, and don't believe anyone who tells you there is. These are all things people dream up to comfort themselves against the scary feeling that none of this matters and you don't matter. But the truth is, none of this matters and you don't matter. Then he patted me on the head. I have no idea what my face would have looked like then. Ashen? It was as if a big feather comforter had just been ripped off the world. Chaos, he informed me, was our only ruler. This massive swirl of dumb forces was what made us, accidentally, and would destroy us, imminently. It cared nothing for us, not our dreams, our intentions, our most virtuous of actions. "Never forget," he said, pointing to the pine needly soil beneath the deck. "As special as you might feel, you are no different than an ant. A bit bigger, maybe, but no more significant." He paused, consulting the map of hierarchies that existed in his head. "Except, do I see you aerating the soil? Do I see you feeding on timber to accelerate the process of decomposition?" I shrugged. "I do not. So you are arguably less significant to the planet than an ant." Then, to really drive his point home, he threw his arms wide. I thought maybe this was an invitation for a hug, for him to say, "Just kidding, you matter." But instead he said, "Okay, now picture that this is all of time." He palpated a vast, invisible timeline in front of his chest. "Humans have only been around this long." On the word "this," he theatrically pinched his fingers together. "And we will probably be gone soon. And if you zoom out away from the Earth, well," he clucked, "then we're really nothing. There are planets and beyond them more solar systems." I'm not sure if he used the exact words, but nearly two decades later, when I heard astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson say his famous line, "We are a speck on a speck on a speck," I heard my father's call. I don't think I had the language as a 7-year-old to put into words the cold feeling that was starting to swirl up my lungs. So what's the point of any of this? Why go to school? Why glue macaroni to paper? But I spent my childhood quietly inspecting my father's behaviors to find out. He's a lively man, a biochemist with shaky hands who studies ions, the particles that carry the electricity that powers all life, heartbeat, lightning, even thought itself. He doesn't use seatbelts or return addresses. He swims where it's prohibited, and one day came home declaring he was done with sleeves after they had toppled his test tubes one too many times. In a huff, he had stormed toward his closet with a pair of scissors and then spent the next few years going to work dressed in a way that can best be described as academic pirate. He worships the family dog, who is naughty, refuses to follow recipes, enjoys sampling the taste of his discarded test subjects, frog legs, electric ray organs, though my mom drew the line at mice livers, refusing to let him enter her kitchen to fry up the contents of his greasy paper lunch bag. Once, as he and I were walking into the retirement home where his mother lived, an old woman in a wheelchair accidentally cut us off. "Slow down," my father shouted and dropped to the floor, writhing and grimacing as if to insinuate she'd hit him. I was cringing, embarrassed, worried he would scare this poor woman to literal death. But the light that snapped on in her eye, the smile that unfurled across her face made me realize she could handle the joke, was hungry for the joke, for being seen as a person who can handle a joke. "You don't matter" seems to fuel his every step, his every bite. So live as you please. He spent years riding a motorbike, drinks copious amounts of beer, and enters the water whenever possible, with the belliest of flops. He seems to permit himself just one lie to constrain his otherwise voracious hedonism, to form a kind of moral code. While other people don't matter either, treat them like they do. He has made my mom coffee almost every morning for half a century. He is devoted to his students. They came to our holiday meals. They sometimes lived in our home. Our kitchen table is etched with thousands of tiny numbers, carved in his shaky hand, a physical record of the countless nights he spent trying to get my sisters and me to comprehend the beauty of math. What could be a grim reality has instead pumped his life full of vigor, has made him live big and good. I've strived my whole life to follow in his nihilistic clown-shoed footsteps, to stare our pointlessness in the face and waddle along toward happiness because of it. But I haven't always been so good at it. You don't matter has often had a different effect on me. Don't get too squeamish. Camus estimates it's on the mind of a majority of us at any moment. That remedy for pain so enticing that 18th century poet William Cowper smartly termed it the grand temptation. For me, it started beckoning when I was in fifth grade, around the time my oldest sister got bullied so badly she had to drop out of high school. My sweet sister with my father's black hair, who wore maroon-rimmed glasses over her dark eyes and shiny braces on her quick-to-smile teeth, who got anxious easily and had trouble understanding social cues, who would flail her hands and pull out her eyelashes and eyebrows when she was stressed. I hated her classmates for not going easier on her, for not cutting her some slack. I hated picturing her walking those hallways and not finding a single pair of eyes offering her refuge. Sometimes it felt nicer not to picture it at all. I tried to console myself, though, as my dad seemed to do with Earth's pleasures. Mud pies and fireflies and dams. Oh, how I loved building a good rain dam. Once dammed a gutter so good it attracted a duck. But when I got to middle school, the hallways started turning on me, too. "Where's your hammer?" the boys sneered, tugging at the loops in my carpenter pants. They mocked the way I wore my baseball cap, apparently too low. They called me Jerry, and I didn't understand why. In ninth grade, I walked by a group of boys who shouted, "Seven!" It was so clear they were rating girls, ranking us as we walked by. Seven, I thought, not bad. Until I found out it was the number of beers they would need to drink to have sex with me. Seven. Complete annihilation, then, to be worthy of touch. I knew a braver girl, a sturdier soul, would laugh back at the boys. I knew how very small my problems were. But I didn't have that thing inside me, whatever it was. When I felt for a backbone, all I found was sand. As I grew older, things only got worse for my sister. She tried going to community college but had to come home after things blew up with her roommate. She earned a degree but had trouble holding jobs. She was too flustered by the cash register, too chatty for the library. She'd come home at night to my mom's worry, my father's disappointment, and bellow behind her bedroom door. I'd picture her changing into elemental form, this tornado of loneliness and tears, and it scared me when she emerged with her face vacuumed of its eyebrows and lashes. Not because it looked alien, but because I knew a sadness that powerful lurked inside me, too. I preferred to vent it by slicing little nicks into my skin, was all. My dad seemed weary of both of us, though, impatient for us to cheer up, to get it together, see the good in life, and enjoy our time on this rock before it was over. "There is grandeur in this view," scolds a quote from Darwin hanging over my dad's desk at his lab. The words are written in looping brown calligraphy, enclosed in a varnished wooden frame. The quote comes from the last sentence of On the Origin of Species. It is Darwin's sweet nothing, his apology for deflowering the world of its God, his promise that there is grandeur. If you look hard enough, you'll find it. But sometimes it felt like an accusation. If you can't see it, shame on you. When my father's mood was off, when he'd had too long of a day, too many sips of beer or bourbon, he'd stomp up the stairs to communicate he'd had enough of our shit, breaking his cardinal rule, other people matter, by slamming doors or shaking us, a few times slapping my sister so hard it left pink imprints on her skin. My mother would cry under the mounting tension of it all. My middle sister, who had once been a pillar to us all, had understandably begun to extract herself, studying abroad in the deserts of Mali by the time I had landed in the 10th grade. I remember thinking that there didn't seem to be anywhere good to get to, that the outside world offered only vicious hallways, empty horizons, the inside world only slamming doors. "I see nothing gleaming," I wrote in my journal on April 8th, 1999, a Sunday. I was newly 16. After school the next day, I drove to Walgreens. I made my way to the aisle full of sleeping pills. Some of the boxes were light blue, some of them dark blue, some of them purple. They all twinkled with papery white stars promising slumber. I slipped a few lavender boxes under my coat. I did not want to cause suspicion. When I made it home for dinner, everything felt lighter. I waited until the house had gone to sleep. Mom, Dad, curled into each other, great at not fighting when not conscious, down. Oldest sister, fish-like lids mercifully shut for the evening, down. Middle sister sleeping in the home of another, better family somewhere in the middle of Africa, down. Tiny white dog Charlie, down. I tiptoed down to the basement. I had not yet read that animals tend to burrow when they're ready to die. I only knew that I was drawn there. I made a ceremony of popping each pill out of its little plastic bubble, one pill per minute, even atheist-like ritual. I awoke to bright lights. The humiliation of a nurse, my worried mother in a hospital chair, paper sheets beneath my ass, a grid of styrofoam ceiling tiles as far as the eye could see. I thought about how they looked like saltines. No, stone wheat thins. No, saltines. It was the next day. I was prescribed Paxil, which I was too proud to take. I was banned from attending a school field trip, deemed too much of a risk. The knowledge of what I did snaked odorlessly through the school hallways. I bought pink lip gloss and smiled extra hard and vowed next time I'd do it right. I began fantasizing about an object, a shiny metal object that would do the job better than pills. By the end of high school, there were days the temptation was so great, I could hardly see past it. But when I landed in college, I noticed what looked like a gleaming, a goofy, doofy, curly-haired man with broad shoulders brushed by me in the hallway one day. He smelled like cinnamon. He had teddy brown eyes and performed in the college's improv group. He was the best one by far, made big gestures, made jokes from a place of kindness and whimsy, pulled ripples of laughter out of this cold, hard world. I used to sit in the audience and marvel. He seemed like an impossibility. It took years. Years of slowly befriending him through mutual friends, years of calling into his late-night freestyle rap radio show and daring my tongue to try to rhyme on the fly. I even joined the improv group. And eventually, one night, I told him how I felt, and instead of flinching away, as I assumed he would, as the boys in the hallway had made it seem that he would, he kissed me. After graduating college, we moved in together, to a small one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn with a red formica table and a great front stoop. I finagled my way into helping produce a radio program all about science and wonder. He was continuing with comedy, stand-up and improv and writing, and working as a yellow cab driver to support himself. We stayed up late into the night, sipping beers on the stoop, talking about our days, turning awkward moments and missteps into jokes. I felt like I had found the thing I had thought could never exist, refuge. It smelled like cinnamon, and its walls were made of bad puns and cheap rhymes, piling higher and higher against the chill of the world. My head became full of visions for the future. The TV shows we would write, the tree houses we would build, the way the grass would curl between our toes as we chased our kids through the yard. Until, 7 years into it, I toppled the whole thing. Late one night on a beach 500 miles away from him, possessed by moonlight and red wine and the smell of a bonfire, I reached out for the bouncing blonde girl I had been trying not to eye all night. She was wet from swimming. She was prickled in goosebumps, hundreds of goosebumps that I wanted to press flat with my tongue. She smiled as I placed my hand on her waist, as I touched my lips to her neck. The stars wrapped around us. Her steam became mine. When I told the curly-haired man what I had done, he told me it was over. But I did not want to believe him, that I could so quickly ruin this intricate thing we had built together over the years. I begged him to reconsider. I assured him the girl thing was a blip, a slip-up, that it would never happen again. But he was too angry, too hurt. He did not want to be with the kind of person who could be that reckless. Without him, the world went dark. Our friends knew what I had done and drew away from me. I avoided my family, not wanting to explain what had happened. My work, the science stories I had once chased with such glee, fell flat. Just proof in various disciplines, chemistry, neurology, entomology, of how bleak and meaningless it all was. Slowly, the grand temptation began to reappear in my mind, its barrel beckoning, offering its most glorious gift, relief. But from somewhere deep inside me, a backbone there, after all, a deluded corner of my brain, I came up with an alternate plan. Maybe, if I repented hard enough, long enough, the curly-haired man would eventually see how sorry I was and take me back. So I grabbed my weapon, a pen. I wrote him letter after letter. I waited, I hoped, I lobbed the occasional lame joke his way, our secret bird call. Happy dozen, I emailed on the first day of 2012. No response. I tried not to worry as 1 year turned to 2, 2 to 3, as the silence out my windows whirred louder and louder, the second law of thermodynamics flexing her bottomless tail. I tried to keep faith. And that is why David Starr Jordan called out to me. I wondered what it was that allowed him to keep plunging his sewing needle at chaos, in spite of all the clear warnings that he would never prevail. I wondered if he had stumbled across some trick, some prescription for hope in an uncaring world. And because he was a scientist, I held on to the distant possibility that his justification for persistence, whatever it was, fit into my father's worldview. Perhaps he had cracked something essential about how to have hope in a world of no promises, about how to carry forward on the darkest days, about how to have faith without faith. But after reading about David's experience on Penakis Island, I was beginning to worry. If God was the light that lit his search through dark times, then he didn't have any more to teach me. I found my answer when he encountered Darwin. After leaving Penakis Island, David took a job as a science teacher at a small prep school in Appleton, Wisconsin. And the ideas of Darwin, which had just been whispers when David was a little boy, had become a gale force wind with which every serious scientist needed to contend. On the Origin of Species was filled with all kinds of heresies, that all life on Earth evolved from one primordial form, that humans are still evolving and could, one day, even go extinct. But perhaps the most difficult idea for a taxonomist to accept was that species were not hard, immutable categories in nature. Darwin had observed so much variety in creatures traditionally assumed to be one species that his sense of a hard line between species had slowly begun to dissolve. Even that most sacred line, the supposed inability of different species to create fertile offspring, he realized was bunk. It cannot be maintained that species, when intercrossed, are invariably sterile, Darwin writes, or that sterility is a special endowment and sign of creation, leading him finally to declare that species, and indeed all those fussy ranks taxonomists believe to be immutable in nature, genus, family, order, class, etc., were human inventions. Useful but arbitrary lines we draw around an ever-evolving flow of nature for our, quote, convenience. Natura non facit saltum, he writes. Nature doesn't jump. Nature has no edges, no hard lines. Imagine how troubling that would be to you if you were a taxonomist, learning that the objects you held in your hands were not puzzle pieces after all, not clues, but products of randomness. They were not pages in a sacred text, not symbols in a holy code, not rungs on a divine ladder. They were snapshots of chaos in motion. For some, the idea was too maddening. It made the earth feel too bleak, their pursuit too pointless. Louis Agassiz remained adamantly opposed to Darwin until his dying day. He lectured widely on the topic, calling the idea that humans could have evolved from apes, quote, repulsive. But David Starr Jordan, of a younger generation with a still malleable mind, decided eventually, torturously, to break with his master on just this count. The closer he looked at nature, the more he realized he couldn't deny Darwin's observations, the reality of the gray area between species. He was beginning, reluctantly, to see it too. He writes, "I went over to the evolutionists with the grace of a cat the boy leads by its tail across the carpet." Oh, how this line made me adore David. It made me want to wrap my arms around his chest, plant a kiss on his begrudging cheek, and tell him he was brave, he was good, for heeding the devastating truth of evolution and finding a way to forge on. It meant, of course, that I could keep using him as my guide. It meant that perhaps as brazen as he seemed with his sewing needle sword, he operated from a place of reason.